wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish.
Good morning. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and this is the Prison Voices Project. I'm your co-host, Karanja Keita Carroll, along with Alexandra Cox.
I'm Alexandra Cox, one of your co-hosts and a professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz. This week we have a packed show. We have some updates and commentary on Baltimore and Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then we will also be discussing a course that we have been teaching at a juvenile facility just down the road from Hudson, Brookwood Secure Center. As always, if you would like to give us feedback about our show, you can reach us at prisonvoicesproject@gmail.com. That's prisonvoicesproject@gmail.com. Or at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. That's 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. We're going to begin today's show by listening to an excerpt from Counterspin, a show on WBAI, which featured some commentary on Baltimore that we wanted to share with our listeners.
You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Public protests around a series of police killings of black people have put a needed spotlight on the experiences of many African American communities with police brutality and racism. But when protesters from Ferguson to Baltimore have a chance to speak, their concerns rarely stop at policing. On a short list of other community issues you're likely to find, substandard, segregated, sometimes dangerous housing. To the extent that that factor is engaged in public and media conversation, the explanations for it are often cursory and sometimes downright misleading. Activists and their allies are trying to push the present moment of focus into a substantive, sustained response to the myriad impacts of white supremacy on U.S. life. And understanding housing conditions like those in the Baltimore neighborhood where Freddie Gray lived and died is key to moving that conversation forward. Joining us now to talk about that is Richard Rothstein. He's research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and author of, among other titles, Grading Education, Getting Accountability Right. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Richard Rothstein.
Thank you very much.
Well, your recent piece that's been picked up by The Washington Post's Valerie Strauss, among others, is titled From Ferguson to Baltimore, The Fruits of Government-Sponsored Segregation. And I'd like you to explain some of the expressions of that segregation, but also I noticed that NPR's description of your May 6th interview said Richard Rothstein talks about what he calls government-sponsored segregation. So what are some of the policies that you're talking about in this piece, and is it really just your own notion, the existence and the intention of these policies?
Well, we have a myth in this country that we have what the lawyers call de facto segregation, that we created these neighborhoods like the inner city of Baltimore that are almost all black, that are poor, that are segregated from mainstream society by accident, either because black people were too poor to move to the suburbs, or because there was private prejudice, or because there was white flight of people who didn't want to live near blacks. And although some of that is true, the bigger cause, the most important cause of segregation, is public policy that was deliberately intended for the first two-thirds of the 20th century to separate black and white families. And segregation was a government policy. It was racially conscious. It was not the unintended consequence of benign policies. It was designed by federal, state, and local governments to segregate our communities. And this was true in every metropolitan area in the country. Now, in Baltimore, in the early 20th century, Baltimore actually passed an ordinance defining which blocks blacks could live on and which blocks whites could live on. When that kind of ordinance was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1917, the mayor of Baltimore set up a committee on segregation to make sure that even without the ordinance still being in effect, that housing inspectors, that health inspectors would enforce segregation. And if any family in a white neighborhood were to sell to a black family, the housing and health inspectors would make sure that the black family could no longer live there. And this kind of thing went on at local level for many years. Then the federal government played a major role in explicitly segregating neighborhoods in Baltimore and throughout the country. The first civilian public housing program began in the New Deal under the Public Works Administration. It was a New Deal program to create housing for civilian population. And it was segregated. The director of the Public Works Administration in the Franklin Roosevelt administration established what he called a neighborhood composition rule, which was that public housing could only be established for people of the race in the neighborhood where the public housing was established. In fact, many of the public housing projects were established in integrated neighborhoods. They tore down integrated neighborhoods and created segregated neighborhoods in their place. That's one of the things that happened in St. Louis, for example, that led to the kind of situation we have in Ferguson. That continued. Public housing continued to be segregated throughout the 20th century up until the mid-1950s. In 1949, President Truman proposed a massive expansion of public housing programs in this country. At the time, there was still a civilian housing shortage, so public housing was for whites, not just for blacks. And in order to try to defeat his public housing proposal, Republicans in Congress put forward what they called a poison pill amendment. That was an amendment that would require public housing to be integrated. Knowing that if the amendment passed, Southern Democrats would then no longer vote for public housing, and the entire public housing program would be defeated. So liberal Democrats in the Senate and the House, led by people like Hubert Humphrey, campaigned against the integration amendment, because they argued that if the public housing was integrated, there would be no public housing at all. And this was true throughout the country. This was not just for the South. And so segregated public housing was created throughout the country. The biggest federal policy, probably, was the policy of the Federal Housing Administration, which financed, starting in the early 1940s, builders of subdivisions, mass production builders of places like you're familiar with in Levittown, New York, or Daly City in California, and subdivisions everywhere in between. They financed builders to create subdivisions of single-family homes in the suburbs on condition that they be sold to whites only. That was an explicit condition of the Federal Housing Administration financing of bank loans to developers. So while whites and blacks were of similar incomes, returning war veterans, for example, working-class families, could have afforded to buy into the suburbs, only whites were permitted to do so. Blacks were consigned not only to urban ghettos, but to segregated public housing in urban ghettos. And those are the kinds of policies that resulted in what we see in Baltimore today, what we saw in St. Louis, and what we've seen around the country for the last 50 years. One more thing. In 1970, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development of the Nixon administration was a fellow named George Romney, the father of the recent presidential candidate. George Romney understood everything that I've just described to you, as did most people at that time. We've forgotten this history. George Romney said that the federal government had created a white noose around inner city ghettos. And it was the job of the federal government now to untie that noose. And George Romney began a program which he called Open Communities, in which he denied federal funds to suburbs that refused to desegregate. And one of the first test cases he made of this policy of denying federal funds for sewers and parkland and water projects was to Baltimore County. And he told Baltimore County that it was not going to get any more federal funds for any urban projects unless it repealed its exclusionary zoning ordinance, that is, ordinance that prohibited the construction of multifamily dwellings in the suburbs, unless it accepted public housing with African Americans, and unless it accepted subsidized low-income housing. Baltimore County was one of the first places that he tried to do that. Mm-hmm. Eventually, George Romney was reined in by the Nixon administration because there was a white backlash to his desegregation policies. And Romney himself was eventually forced out as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And we've had nothing as aggressive in way of desegregation since. So this history is once well known. It was once widely accepted and understood that segregation was not an accident, but it was a purposeful creation of state, federal, and local government. And we've now forgotten that we think that it happened by accident. And when we think it happened by accident, we then think there's nothing we can do about it. Whereas if we understood that this was the product of government policy, we would understand that there are government policies that could reverse it.
And maybe it should go without saying, but of course the connection between housing ownership and the accumulation of wealth is absolutely critical. So these policies explain even more than where people live.
Well, that's correct. I mean, when you concentrate the low-income population in an area, of course, they become more low-income because they don't have access to jobs. And as you probably know, in the 1950s, jobs began to move from urban areas out to suburbs because African Americans were concentrated in a noose, as George Romney said, in central cities. They had no access to the jobs that were being created, so the community became poorer than it was before. Schools have to deal with problems that would be easily handled if they were not in great numbers. That is, if any school has children who come from families who don't have stable housing or have parents who aren't literate and don't read to them often and have stress from frequent unemployment, if any school has a few children like that, a teacher in a classroom can devote special attention to those children and can remediate their problems. If you have schools where virtually every child has those problems, there's nothing the school can do to devote special attention to every child, so the whole quality of instruction declines. So all of the problems that we face today in terms of inequality by race are attributable in large part to federal housing policies that were designed to create segregation.
Well, let me just ask you finally, unfortunately for corporate media, underlying problems are often where a story ends. You know, you report on community anger about police violence, for example, and then at the end you kind of wave your hat toward underlying problems, you know, the real things that need to change, but you leave them as kind of a muddle and go on about your business. And then with the next incident, we say, oh, wow, this again, or, you know, why haven't we been hearing about this until now? Do you have any thoughts about how reporting could be useful in engaging, given that reporters are going to talk about Baltimore, they're going to talk about Ferguson? What are some of the things you'd like to see them doing more of as they have that conversation?
Well, I'd like to see them doing more of the things that you and I have been talking about, going into the history, trying to explain to their readers and their listeners and their viewers how we came to have the kinds of desperate, low-income, segregated communities like we have in Baltimore, like we have in Ferguson, like we have in cities around the country. If people come to understand this history and they understand that government created segregation and government created the concentration of social problems in certain areas, they will understand that the government not only has a responsibility, but a constitutional obligation to reverse the effects of those policies.
We've been speaking with Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute. You can find his work on their site. It's epi.org. Richard Rothstein, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. Next, we're going to hear a song by Divine RBG called Things Ain't Right.
There's no milk or cereal, and I'm hungry.
You checked the refrigerator?
Yes, we don't have any milk or cereal.
Okay.
We need food.
All right.
Politics is a pile of tricks. Politics is only poly with the people trying to get what they trying to get. Get you for your ideas, resources, and my years. Nothing's been done for the people that live right here. The Bronx still burnt down. Young people get turned out, thinking that living off the system's gonna work out. Addicted to the welfare, no quality healthcare. Been to hospitals in the Bronx, just living hell there. Been on Section 8, been eating free lunches. Been job hunting for summers, it's still nothing. I know that the change he promised, it ain't coming. I know politicians be lying, they stay frontin'. If we want change to come, it's on us. And the almighty dollar is the one you can't trust. Unemployment up, crime rate up, education cut, the war's on us. From the foods that we eat to the way that we think, from the books that we read to the way we raise our seeds. See, when I was coming up, Dead Press taught me that.
Good morning, WGXC listeners. We wanted to update you on the current condition of political prisoner, former Black Panther, and Black journalist from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal. We have a clip from Johanna Fernandez, professor of history along with Black and Puerto Rican studies at Baruch College.
Hello everyone, I'm Dashaun Farad. Welcome to Your Black World. Here to give us an update on Mumia Abu-Jamal is Dr. Johanna Fernandez. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Please tell us what's going on with Mumia briefly. We don't want to keep you.
There is an attempt at a public execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia remains seriously ill. I visited him last Sunday, and although he's able to walk, he still has difficulty walking, and what is most distressing is that his skin condition has in fact worsened. Over the course of the 3 hours that I visited him, he was also shaking throughout the visit. Mumia's skin condition is severe, and it is a symptom of a deeper systemic problem. We need to find out what that systemic problem is, and for that, we need to ensure that he gets specialized medical care immediately.
And before we go, we want to know, with all the evidence that can prove Mumia's innocence or even grant him a new trial, why are they prohibiting him from receiving a new trial or from acquitting him?
Well, the reason why he's not been able to get relief in the appellate process is because the Fraternal Order of Police has hugely influenced the judiciary. For example, in one of the major appeals cases, the judge presiding over the hearing, Judge Castile, was asked to recuse himself because he was identified as Man of the Year by the Fraternal Order of Police. Judge Castile, who's the head of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, turned around and wrote a response to Mumia's attorneys who asked him to recuse himself. And Judge Castile said, if I must recuse myself, then five other judges in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court must recuse themselves because they too have accepted contributions from the Fraternal Order of Police. So the Fraternal Order of Police has essentially rigged the appellate process in Mumia's case and has prevented the reality of Mumia's innocence from being heard in court.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fernandez, for joining us. And this is Dashaun Farage. You're listening to Your Black World. Don't forget to check us out at yourblackworld.com. And also, you can listen to Dr. Boyce Watkins' commentaries on YouTube. Have an excellent day.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. Next, we're going to hear a song by FM Leyte called Gimme Love and Truth.
Good morning, and you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. This is the Prison Voices Project.
In January of 2015, my colleague Karanja Carroll and I started teaching at Brookwood Secure Center. We decided that it would be an interesting opportunity for our students at SUNY New Paltz to do an inside-out course. Inside Out is a national model which exists in prisons and juvenile facilities across America, which brings students from colleges into prisons and juvenile facilities in a joint college course with people who are incarcerated inside. There are several Inside Out programs across New York State, but we were the first to do this kind of program inside of a juvenile facility in the state. We selected 12 SUNY New Paltz students to participate in the class, and then there were 10 inside students. Brookwood Secure Center is located outside of Claverack, and it's a facility which houses young people accused of felonies as adults between the ages of 13 and 15, and also young people adjudicated as delinquents who are what is called fennered up to a secure facility, which is really just stepped up to a secure facility from a lower level facility. The facility itself has about 180 beds and houses a college program which is full-time, and as of today there have been 3 graduates from the college program with a full-time with associate's degrees. The college program is associated with Columbia Green Community College, and it offers a liberal arts diploma, associate's diploma. We joined up with the college program there to offer the class to 10 of the inside students and 12 of the outside students, and the class itself was called Social Problems. We identified a class that was offered at both Columbia Green Community College and New Paltz so as to facilitate ease of access with credits. I taught the class jointly with Dr. Karanja Carroll, who's in the Black Studies Department, and I'm in the Sociology Department at SUNY New Paltz, and our college supported us in funding the program actually through an old foundation account that used to support prison education. Back before Pell Grants were cut in 1994, SUNY New Paltz used to have a full-time master's degree program in sociology that was offered at Eastern Correctional Facility. And SUNY New Paltz also used to offer bachelor's degrees inside. So we were really excited to resurrect the SUNY New Paltz effort and bring it to Brookwood. We began the course in January, and we selected 5 texts to read. The books we were reading were around the themes of racism, education, and mass incarceration. And we also looked at issues around gender, heterosexism, and kind of the intersections between race, class, and gender, and their effects on young people in particular in the systems of education and mass incarceration. We chose books in part because we knew that if all of our students were going to be meeting each other where they were at, it was important that they have access to the same kinds of materials, and the students inside don't have access to computers. The books were everything from a book called White Supremacy and Racism in the Post-Civil Rights Era by Eduardo Bonilla Silva to Lockdown America by Christian Parenti to one of our favorites, which is The Education of Little B, which is by Elaine Brown, who's a former Black Panther. Our students had to write several essays during the course of the semester, and they have a graduation on May 14th, this Thursday, the day of our show, in which they're going to be presenting group projects that they did around the topic of prison education, including an op-ed, a manifesto, a history of prison education, and the results of some interviews that they did with each other for the class. Today on our show, we wanted to share some of our students' observations about the class and also some of our own. In our experience, this was really a kind of challenging and in some ways quite difficult experience of teaching inside, and one that we really hadn't encountered before. It was also very rewarding. We got to spend a huge amount of time with the students each Thursday. We had 3 hours in the classroom and then 2 hours going up and back from SUNY New Paltz, and really focused on trying to build the classroom community amongst our students. Our own pedagogical style is one that's really rooted around active learning and using teaching as a way of getting students to unlock some of the kinds of barriers that have existed as a result of many, many years of educational models, which are largely focused on talking at them, not speaking with them. We ourselves decided that we were not going to read the books beforehand, that we wanted to read the books with our students, and also really focus on the text as a way of helping to build a strong understanding of the theoretical concepts that we were engaging in. My colleague, Dr. Karanja Carroll, is going to talk a little bit more about what happened inside of the class and some of the kinds of challenges and opportunities created by the class.
As Dr. Cox just stated, we taught a course entitled Social Problems, and the description reads as follows. This course is a critical examination of social problems in the U.S. context. The problems that we are covering are racism, sexism, heterosexism, incarceration, and education. We will rely upon close reading, open discussion, and reflective writing exercises to navigate through these issues. The goal of the class is to provide students with a critical lens to understand contemporary social issues. And again, the reason why we went with this course was because both bodies of students would be able to receive credit for the class, but also the course is broad enough to engage topics that the students should be reflecting upon as they grow, develop into mature human beings. One of the first books that we started with was Bonilla Silva's White Supremacy and Racism in the Post-Civil Rights Era. This is a book that I have actually taught for a number of years. As Dr. Cox stated, these books we didn't read, but this is the only book that I actually read from cover to cover beforehand. And Bonilla Silva provides a very good foundation to understanding contemporary manifestations of racism. You know, living in this post-civil rights era, living in this post-black era, living in this moment of post-racialism, all of this logic and thinking makes us assume and seem as if racism is no longer a factor. And Bonilla Silva outlines how racism is clearly still a factor, but no longer do we have people doing and saying explicitly racist things. We see them speaking about racial matters in coded language. This book, again, provided a good foundation for us to understand how at the very root of a lot of the problems as it relates to educational inequality, as it relates to mass criminalization, as it relates to mass incarceration, is this problem of racism, which is at the root. The next book that we read was entitled Hopeful Girls, Troubled Boys by Nancy Lopez, and text which tries to analyze the unique gendered experiences of Caribbean immigrants who are being educated within the New York public school system. And it was very good to have students think about the way in which gender shapes educational experiences. And, you know, the inside students are all males of color, and it was very interesting to see how they grappled with that reality of really thinking about how, you know, the educational system is set up and it privileges black and brown women to advance through the educational system with extreme support. And a lot of the inside students and some of the outside students, males of color, were able to make those connections. But what was also important was that we tried to stress to the students that there are actually counter narratives that push back against certain definitions, certain discussions of who is benefiting from education. And one of the points that I tried to stress to all of them was that all of you males of color who are in this course are actually a counter narrative. You actually push back against the narrative that says that only black and brown women advance through education. Not only, but primarily black and brown women advance through education. The fact that you are here and participating in this course shows that that is not true. And those counter narratives become important because those counter narratives are actually living and they are actually fruitful, insightful, and insightful. The next text that we covered was "Dude, You're a Fag" by C.J. Pascoe, and within this book, the author was really trying to grapple with questions of maleness, sexuality, heteronormativity within the high school experience of young people within California. And again, you know, this put a lot of questions and topics on the table as it relates to sexuality, as it relates to sexual norms and things of that nature, which was very good and important for everyone, both inside and outside, to have a detailed critical discussion of. The next book that we covered was Lockdown America by Christian Perini, which covered so many important components of the issues as it relates to the prison industrial complex. And in doing so, this text set the foundation for the next text that we were going to move into, which will be our last one. And that is The Condemnation of Little B by Elaine Brown. Condemnation of Little B covers the story of a Little B, a young man accused of the murder of a man in Atlanta, Georgia. And it outlines his whole experience and the way in which many people were complicit in his incarceration. Many people who one would assume should not be complicit. And the students were able to connect to this book because it pulled together many of the previous themes. But on top of that, Elaine Brown does a beautiful job of providing historical context for understanding how we got to this point as it relates to issues of incarceration, as it relates to issues of juvenile justice. The book is over 300 pages, and it is extremely intense, but it is a very, very good read that I believe that the students enjoy. As it relates to questions of pedagogy, I think that the approach to teaching on the inside was no different from an approach that both myself or Dr. Cox would take on teaching on the outside. We are concerned with close reading as a technique. We are concerned with open discussion as technique. We are concerned with group projects, group facilitation of discussion as technique. We are concerned with the students challenging one another just as much as they challenge their instructors. And, you know, I see that as a pedagogy of liberation. And when we think about a pedagogy of liberation, we're thinking about how is it possible that education can free someone? Especially, how can education free someone who is in a place that is physically, that they're physically locked within? And that is when the dynamics of prison education just come out, and they're also evident. When we know that education can be a mechanism to free people. So people might be physically locked up and locked down for that matter, but education liberates them. Education takes them out of that space. You know, it becomes extremely, extremely important to think through education from this perspective, and it was this perspective that informed our position on how we were trying to teach this course, what we were trying to get out of this course, and hopefully what this course is able to give back to us as instructors, to affirm the importance of prison education, to affirm the importance of not giving up on populations of people that some folks have totally given up on.
Up next, you'll hear from our students about their responses to the class. Before you hear from our students, we're going to play a song by Asha called Jailer.
This is a song by the wonderful Asha. It's called Jailer. I'm in chains, you're in chains too. I wear uniforms, you wear uniforms too. I'm a prisoner, you're a prisoner too, Mr. Jailer. I have fears, you have fears too. I will die, but sir, yourself gon' die too. Life is beautiful, don't you think so too, Mr. Jailer? I'm talking to you, jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let he who is without sin be the first to cast this stone, Mr. Jailer. You suppress all my strategy. You oppress every part of me. What you don't know, you're a victim to, Mr. Jailer. I'm talking to you, jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let he who is without sin be the first to cast his stone, Mr. Jailer.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Dr. Alexandra Cox. Next, you're going to hear from a series of SUNY New Paltz students who took a course inside of Brookwood Juvenile Secure Center, which is located just outside of Hudson. These students are going to be talking about their experience in the class, which we've been discussing on today's show.
I think this course was unique to our... Well, to my undergrad experience personally, because I just think we got to sit in an environment and a class of students where half of us are not really considered capable of being students in our society. And I also think that we got to sit there and actually acknowledge the fact that these individuals are brilliant in every way, shape, and form, and that their experience doesn't, like, stop them from being these people and stop them from trying to achieve goals that people wouldn't really think that incarcerated people would want to achieve. I also think that we got a chance to sit there and just personally analyze how we every day sometimes somehow contribute to these stereotypes and maintaining them alive. And it was just overall absolutely positive. Like, it was challenging in ways where we wouldn't be challenged in, like, in a New Paltz classroom. We got to sit in a classroom and have two different teachers that had different teaching styles, but even, like, watching them come together as one, in a way, to teach us was inspiring, and it was just overall a great experience.
I think this experience has been quite unique because in a traditional liberal arts college, you know, you often expect it to be a really diverse environment where people are coming from, you know, they're bringing different things to the table. And I always thought that about my education until I took this class. And I realized how similar the people that sit in my typical classes are to me, coming from the same places and generally the same backgrounds. And it's, you know, makes for a repetitive conversation so often. But this was so unique, and we had so many different voices and different experiences being heard. That's definitely what I took away from it.
What were some of the unique voices and experiences that you heard that you did not hear in a quote-unquote
right.
normal...
Well, in a typical, you know, in my typical college experience, I wouldn't have ever sat next to someone who... I, to my knowledge, have never sat next to someone who has gone through the prison system, who's been incarcerated, whose parents have been, you know, incarcerated, who were, you know, basically like adult children. So many guys told me having to take, you know, at the age of like 10, 11, 12, having to take care of their siblings. Like those narratives I've never gotten. That's sad.
Well, I've never taken a class as challenging in so many ways that a class normally doesn't address, like, beyond any academic dimension. It was more interpersonal and relationship building, and the opportunity to get to know some of these guys on the inside and to be a part of a class full of such genuine people and learn from two dynamic professors has just been really special. And I guess one of the biggest things that I've taken away from it has been putting faces to numbers. Like, when we hear about prisons, we always hear about statistics. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is it helped humanize me to those numbers and make me sensitive to the real human reality behind the millions of people who are incarcerated, and, you know, think about the family webs that are affected and the communities that are affected. So it's made me a lot more conscious of that. And yeah, it was just a really amazing experience. Thank you.
So I felt that this has been a unique experience, especially in a liberal arts school, because of the topics that we talk about in the environment. You know, it's difficult to speak about sexuality and gender and homosexuality in the prison system, being that it's usually not accepted in those environments. Mm-hmm. Also, it's difficult because, you know, it was more of a student-teacher relationship within everybody in the classrooms. The class was basically a discussion-based class, and being the fact that, you know, everybody put their two cents in, and it was a lot of ideas and a lot of views that aren't usually seen and or heard of because of the fact that those students are behind bars, and it's not fair to them. And being part of this class allowed me to take back what I learned and bring it back to my environment. So, like, I will go home and talk to my brothers and sisters, my frat brothers, all my friends, and just talk about this course and how amazing it is and how these people are categorized as animals and, you know, they should be trapped behind bars. But in reality, these people are human beings just like us, smarter than us in ways that one cannot imagine. They might not be as book smart due to the fact of resources, but they're phenomenal people, and this experience has been amazing.
I think this experience has definitely been very unique because I was exposed to a lot of new experiences that I haven't been exposed to here in the SUNY UPOS campus. I feel like because of this course, I am no longer oblivious to the issues that are present in our society, and I'm more open-minded towards, like, what's wrong with our society. And because of this course, I realized how important it is for us to save our youth and how important it is for us to stop throwing in all our Black and Latino men and females into facilities in hopes of making our communities a better place. So I feel like we should focus on fixing our communities and repairing our communities and making it better for everyone in hopes of eliminating, you know, future crimes and future people getting incarcerated. This course has definitely been very life-changing and has definitely taught me a lot about myself. I feel like I've grown in many different ways. I feel like because of this course, I am much more educated on the prison system. I'm much more educated on the juvenile system and everything that I was very close-minded towards because of the society I grew up in. And because of this course, I realized how growing up in the Bronx and constantly being told that people that are in prison are animals or that they're really bad people, you know, that that's a stigma that has stuck with me. But now that I took this course and I was exposed to 12 men that have been incarcerated, I realized that the stigma is not necessarily true, that these men are human just as I am human, and they're such smart individuals that have so much potential to be great people, better than what they already are, because they're amazing human beings and they definitely shouldn't be judged based on the worst thing that they've done. So overall, this course has definitely been a very life-changing experience for me, and it's something that I would recommend anybody else to do.
This class has been unique to my liberal arts education because I've been forced to develop critical listening skills, and I've learned a lot about how important it is to really listen to what people are saying and take in what they're saying and process it, as opposed to just blindly responding, and as opposed to always having a response to everything just to prove how smart I am. So this class has been unique because being in a class on the inside with incarcerated students, it's so important to just listen and to just shut up and listen and check my privilege and check myself in the classroom when I'm in the classroom, because it's so important to listen. In addition to critical and active listening skills, it's super important to meet people where they're at and understand that someone might be saying the same exact thing as you, but use completely different words for it. So what I've learned, in addition to listening and processing and really shutting up, is understanding that people have different words for different things, except a lot of the time we're working towards the same goals.
One day in class, Professor Cox was talking to us last semester about going to different education conferences, and she was talking about how there would be a lot of good stuff being talked about, but in the end, she realized that everybody there was an older person, and she said there were no students there to even represent their voice. And this Inside Out course has really spoken to me about the power of how we so often don't bring in the voices of the people who are actually the ones affected most by our system negatively. And I just appreciate so much being able to be in the same room as those people and to hear their voices, because I've had so many judgments and critiques. I just am so grateful for this experience because it's helped me work through my judgments of what it means to be in prison and what it means to commit a crime, because there's so much more to a story. No matter how bad something looks, there's so much to it. And as much as I wanted to look at myself as this open, progressive kid, I am the classic white, hegemonic male who's heterosexual, and I am just I've been so privileged my whole life, and I can't deny the fact that I can't have been exposed to that privilege and that I can't have been a part of it. And being in a class like this really makes me have to stand up to that. And I need to learn how and where my place fits into this whole structure, and how I can make a difference in my own way. And I've been thinking a lot about that recently, but this class has helped me just expose myself to more of the world and more truth and a lot of kindness and a lot of goodness that I'm so honored to have met the people on the inside and the outside, because everyone in this class has been... No, to be honest, the kids on the inside are more genuine and honest than most of the people that I go to school with. And I think that's really cool. So, thank you.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m., on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia Counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12535. 1-800-324-8334. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could.